America has 2.2 million people in prison. If just 1% is wrong, that's 22,000 people. That's a lot of people's lives destroyed.
If the system want to take you out of society, they will do it. No matter what laws they have to break, saying that they are enforcing the laws, but they are breaking the law.
Having to hear those people say that I was guilty of a crime that I did not commit, and then hear my family break down behind me and not be able to do anything about it, I can't describe the crushing weight that was.
I'm not anti-police, I'm just anti-corruption.
A lot of times we look and we see something happen to somebody, and that's the first thing we say, that could never happen to me, but it can.
This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Today I have an unusually strong group of guests, and I say group because, first of all, the star of our show, who was on his way to being a star baseball player, actually, before this insanity happened, is Jimmy Gardner.
Jimmy C. Gardner shares his story of being wrongfully convicted and incarcerated for almost 27 years.
Jimmy Gardner was a Charleston, West Virginia minor league baseball player, and he was accused of sexual assault in 1987. His case was overturned after investigators found out the state's expert lied on the witness stand, but his fight for justice is far from over.
Jimmy, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
Scott Bolden, his attorney, is here. Scott, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you for having us.
And a very unusual occurrence is happening here at Wrongful Conviction today. This is a great pleasure for me and an honor to have you here, Your Honor, because we have the Honorable Leslie Abrams here, federal judge from Georgia. So, Judge, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, Jimmy.
Yes.
Now, first of all, let me just contextualize, because obviously you can't see, but Jimmy may well be the handsomest guy we've ever had on the show. He's 6'4" and looks like a movie star, but you were actually a pitcher.
Yes.
In the Cubs organization.
Yes.
Which is an interesting story, too. But I want to go further back than that.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure.
Where did you grow up? How did you grow up? How was your life before it really was going to a place that all of us, like me as a child, I fantasized about. I wanted that life. I wanted to play for the Mets.
Yes.
But okay. And then it turned into a horror show. But how did it start?
Yeah, I'll take you back to the very beginnings. I am originally born in Dawson, Georgia. We left when I say two. My mother says 3 years old. So I'll go with three. We left and went to Tampa, Florida. And in Tampa, Florida, that's where I was raised at. I went through the Tampa, Florida school system, Hillsborough County school system. I played sports in the Tampa Bay area, football, baseball, basketball, just a variety of sports.
Were you a star in the other sports as well? I imagine you were a star in baseball.
Well, I'm not going to say star. I mean, I'm going to be humble and say I was playing amongst great, great athletes in Tampa, Florida. I think the best in the world at those times, in the 70s, early 80s. Yes.
So you had your childhood was good.
Childhood
is that fair
was,
to say?
Childhood was great.
Okay.
Yeah, Tampa, Florida, I strongly let people know I'm from the Bay Area. And basically what you're seeing today is just a representation of everything I came up through Tampa, Florida. Coaches, my family members, great aunts, great uncles, I mean cousins. Just my entire life I've been around nothing but positivity and just total acceptance and uplifting of people that were just good people. And that's Tampa, Florida.
So you chose baseball.
Yes.
How'd it go from there?
Well, I got drafted out of Tampa Bay Vocational Technical High School in 1984 by the Chicago Cubs. And it's a little ironic because playing in 1976-77 with the Little League Cubs, I told my coach, Coach Zeke, God bless his soul, Coach Zeke said, Jimmy C., you are the best in the world. And that was one of his favorite things he'd tell guys. You're the best in the world. And I told him, I said, Coach, I'm going to play for the real Cubs one day. And he said, I know you will. And that was in 1976. So in 1984, I got drafted by the Chicago Cubs.
There you go.
And I played minor league with the Chicago Cubs for 4 seasons. And out of those 4 seasons, I had some good seasons, met some good guys. Played 1984 with Greg Maddux in Pikeville, Kentucky. Played with Jamie Moyer, Joe Girardi. Just a lot of names, a lot of guys I played with and had opportunities to just interact with throughout my career.
And for people who are listening who may not be baseball fans or maybe young, these are legends that we're talking about.
Yeah,
you're just
legends.
Reeling off names that are like, you know, the Hall of Fame,
yeah.
One after the other.
Yeah.
So there you are, waiting to get the call to go to get tapped on the shoulder and go to the big leagues.
Yeah.
And, you know, and wear the Cubs uniform and yes. Wrigley Field and the whole thing.
Yes.
And then everything goes horribly wrong in a way that is, I think, to the average person, unimaginable.
Yes.
And in your case, it's very clear that what happened to you was deliberate on the part of not just one person, but several people who,
yes.
for reasons I'll never understand, just decided that they were going to pin a horrendous, inexplicable crime
yes.
on you. Did you know anything about this crime? It's a crime that happened in West Virginia, right?
Yes. This crime happened in 1987. I was playing for the Charleston Wheelers in Charleston, West Virginia. During the season, I'm going to say, in May, the first crime occurred, and then in June, the next crime occurred. And the crime was a sexual assault against one white woman in May and another white woman in June.
You left out an important detail. We're talking about an 86-year-old woman and her daughter, right? A 60-year-old woman.
Right. In one case, an 80-something-year-old woman and her daughter was assaulted. Her mother was beat up, but the woman was assaulted. In the other case, the woman was about 40-something. And she was assaulted and beat up. And this all came about. The description that the women gave were that this guy was a light to medium complexion African-American, about 6 foot tall.
Right. And for people listening at home, that wouldn't be a way that I would describe you, Jimmy. I mean, Jimmy is a dark-skinned African-American man, was
yes.
about 6'4", and looks taller. So, yeah, the description was pretty off. And it was a description that was given by more than one person.
Yes.
And we know descriptions are not perfect.
Right.
The mind is not a camera. But still, that didn't match up.
No, sir. And during the season, I mean, when these crimes occurred, these horrific crimes occurred, the Charleston Police Department was basically gathering information and rounding up blacks from all over the city. There were over 100, and I believe 140 or 100-plus African-Americans, male, that were rounded up and taken to the police department, fingerprinted, photos, and things of that order, including myself and about 6 black guys off the baseball team. All of us were actually taken to the police department, fingerprinted, photoed. They told me nothing matched. This was in 1987. Fast forward to 1989, I was confronted by policemen from Charleston, West Virginia, saying that my prints now match. One print now matches from a crime scene, but it no longer was a thumbprint. It was now a left middle fingerprint. They just made a mistake on the, I guess, the definition of the print or characterizing the print.
So that's what connects this, right?
That's what connects this.
Yeah,
yes.
So they...
And they said they rechecked my prints, and now they matched.
Magically.
Yes.
They had the wrong finger, they had the wrong this, they had
Well,
the wrong...
they said at the time, the individuals that were in the department didn't have the knowledge of doing fingerprints.
Well, and that's an interesting thing. And Scott, I'd like to turn to you for a second, too, because we know that the standards that are maintained for fingerprint analysis are shoddy at best, right? Especially in smaller towns across
sure.
the country.
Yeah, the Charleston, West Virginia Police Department, or the state police in this case, they had the expertise. They certainly did. They just had a bad actor. The chief serologist for that department, who had been there for several years, was known within the department to either falsify test results or to be sloppy with his analysis as well as in his testimony. So you have the test results, right? They get turned over to the prosecutor, right? Sometimes they get challenged by defense counsel experts. Sometimes they don't. most defendants don't have enough money to hire an expert to do that type of critical analysis. But in this particular case, at the State Department lab, it would later be found that the chief serologist was not only indicted, but investigated at the federal level as well as at the state level, and found that he had not misinterpreted, but purposefully testified falsely on the stand of at least 20 more individuals like Jimmy. And then secondly, that there was knowledge of others that he worked with, that he falsified test results in order to make the analysis match that the prosecutors used in state court to convict individuals like Jimmy Gardner.
Right. And that's, I'm so glad you're talking about it. This was Fred Zane, right?
Fred Zane, absolutely.
An infamous, terrible, we talk about a bad actor. I mean, that's too kind, right? This is a guy who was vicious. He was deliberately, willfully, not because I think so, not because I say so, but because he was convicted of doing that. He was sentenced to 4 to 12 years in prison. Mm-hmm. That's such a troubling fact because, as you said, what is a jury to do, right? They may not be sophisticated people. They're probably not scientists. You got a guy like Jimmy, who's, I'm guessing you were represented by a public defender at that time?
Yes, public defender. I was his first case.
Your first case?
Yes.
Out of law school?
Yes, sir.
Wow. Okay. That's a plot twist, too. So what is, for either of you guys, or even you, Judge Abrams, what is a person to do? Like, if you're sitting at home and you're going, well, if I go on a jury and a guy gets up there and I don't know if he's lying or not, but there's nobody to tell me any different, how is somebody even supposed to get to the truth when you have a guy like that who's up there going, I'm accredited from this university and I went to this and I went to that? What's a person to do?
From my point of view, that's where the pretrial process comes in. That's why we have the adversarial system. If you have a good defense attorney, I want to step back and speak a couple of steps back because I've read the filings in this case, but I wasn't involved in this case. But when I look at it, to even get to the point where you put it before the jury, that's why we have all these processes in place. That's why prosecutors have a duty to turn over any type of exculpatory information. The prosecutor's office, everyone knew about Fred Zane before this trial even happened.
So that's a clear Brady violation.
That's a clear Brady violation. And as far as I know, that information was never turned over. You know that your serologist has had problems, doesn't have the credentials that he's supposed to have. If you're going to use it, first of all, I was a federal prosecutor at one point. I would not have used that information. But if you are going to use it, you have a duty to tell the other side. If your client is telling you, they told me that the blood type didn't match, and now it does, then the defense attorney should have investigated that. So when you're talking about how does a jury know what to do, we do have the system when it works right, when it's not deliberately being undermined, has these stops in place where that testimony never should have come in. A jury never should have been confronted with that.
They had no chance of getting it right. I'm guessing you would probably say, as one of the exonerees, Jason Strong, as he said, you know, I would have convicted me, you know, with the evidence that was presented and the lack of defense that my attorney mounted, I would have convicted me. I mean, maybe you feel the same way in your case.
No, I don't feel that way. My jury deliberated for 4.5 days.
Wow.
They were out, and they'd always come back and say they were deadlocked. And in the beginning, that deadlock was in favor of me from us, I guess, inquiring. But that process went on for 4.5 days.
That's got to be 4.5 days of absolute torture. I mean,
yes, it was. But to hear my attorney saying, this is in our favor. And
how would he know? He just got out of law school.
That midday to come back with a decision of guilty on one case, not guilty on the other case, which was, I believe, a compromised verdict. Mm-hmm. That was devastating. I mean, it even gets worse than that. To add salt to the injury, I go back to the county jail and someone has broken into my cell and took my family photo, my pictures of my family, my address book with my numbers. They've called my lady friend at the time. You know, that was compounded with the guilty verdict. That was a rough day.
Oh, my God. And, you know, one of the things I harp on and that I obsess on is that we have an unequal system of justice in this country, right?
Which is the presumption, though, most of us who are on juries or just the average man and woman, we presume the stability of this institution called justice, called prosecutors, state's attorney's offices, U.S. attorney's offices. We presume, we rely on it. And those systems, if they're not reliable, or if those systems break down, and they break down more often than we think, in regard to a case like Jimmy Gardner, there was a complete breakdown of fairness and justice and an even-handed approach, whether it was the prosecutor, whether it was a public defender whose first case was a double assault case like this, whether it was the judge who forced him to go to trial before this young defense attorney was ready, whether it was the prison system and the guards who worked the courtroom, who went back and presumably took and stole his stuff. We can't presume justice in every jurisdiction. There are justice systems that are unjust against whether they're young, poor black men or young, poor white men, where the system doesn't work. I'm not surprised that Jimmy Gardner was convicted, because he was convicted before he sat down and even tried the case, because those systems not only failed, but those systems were unjust and hell-bent on being unjust towards him. And I'm comfortable saying that as his attorney post-conviction on his part.
Well, you didn't have a hope.
Post-release, rather.
You didn't have a hope in hell. I mean, you really, between all the factors as Scott just pointed out, I mean, you were done. It's actually a miracle that they deliberated for 4.5 days. I would have been less surprised if you said 4.5 hours or 45 minutes, because they were not presented with the facts at all. So I give some credit to the jury that they actually spent that much time, but that didn't help you. I mean, what an extreme, right? You're going from having all-star dreams, from the dream, like I said, that many of us, most American boys grow up with, right? Yeah. Which is playing baseball in the major leagues, which was actually within reach. And all of a sudden, you're going from pretty close to the tippy top to the absolute depths of hell. Can you describe the moment? I mean, you were there for 4.5 days, twisting in the wind. Every day you showed up in court, wishing, hoping, praying, whatever your thing is. Then you not only get convicted, but sentenced to essentially a life sentence, right? 110 years in prison.
Sure.
I mean, what was that moment like?
I mean, I'll back it up a little bit. When I first arrived into Charleston, West Virginia, I can still recall all the guys in the jail cells telling me, they called me Florida. They said, Florida, you can't win here. You just don't go to trial and win here. And I'm telling the guys, I'm not guilty of these crimes, man. They said, man, but you can't win. You don't win in Charleston, West Virginia. And at this time, I'm knowing that I did not do these crimes. And I don't have that worry that you guys are talking about. You guys are talking about. You know, I had the prosecution offer 10 years to me. Hmm. And my lawyer said, he said, Mr. Gardner, this is the best deal that you will ever get. These are 10 years for these type of charges. He said, you go to trial, you'll get 10 times this. He said, you'll get beyond that. He said, this is the best deal. He tried everything to get me to take a deal. I said, I didn't do the crimes. I'm not guilty of these crimes. I'm not pleading guilty to anything. And those 10 years turned into 110 years once I was convicted. And going through that process until I was actually convicted and I heard the jury say guilty, I did not think that I would be found guilty. That's what made it such of a shock going back. Because as I say, the attorney's telling me, the longer they stay out, this is excellent for us. You know, this is excellent. They can't come to an agreement. And the judge steadily sends them back. You got to go back. They said, well, Judge, we're deadlocked. We're at a position we can't move forward. You got to go back.
How long was the trial?
Probably a week. And in the end, I was actually convicted and sentenced to 110 years, which was a shocker to say the least.
To go from that and to come to where you are now, how did you manage to bounce back? How did you manage to persevere? How did you manage to fight?
I mean, it's a process. And that's not a process that's done overnight. At that point, after I was convicted, I mean, I was in shock. But I knew in my mind, I was in for a fight. I knew that there's no time for crying and laying down. That's just the individual that I am and my upbringing. You know, it's not time to really cry and sulk. I know it's time to fight for my life. And I guess I had been bred for this. Adversity is something that I've had to overcome and basically outlast my entire life. And this guilty verdict was a slam to me. But I just know it changed my entire life. The young lady that I was dating at the time, I had to let her know that our relationship was over and let her know that I'm in Charleston, West Virginia with my life basically just taken from me and I got to fight. So I ended a relationship in 1990 that began in 1983. And that was a difficult decision, but I just ended that because I knew now I'm in Charleston, West Virginia, a young man from Tampa, Florida. I'm used to being in a totally different environment. And now I'm Charleston, West Virginia, where it's 98% white in West Virginia and 2% black at that time, which was, that was major to me. But I have to put in my mind, this is live or die. So I can still recall in the courtroom telling my mother and my grandmother, don't cry. You know, I'm telling, don't cry. Do not let them see you cry. Don't show tears. I'm not showing tears at this moment. This is a time that I must be strong, and I wanted them to be strong. So I just remained strong for them, mostly. Of course, when I got back to the cell, I had to let it out. But, you know, it's almost indescribable.
It is. I mean, it's impossible for any of us to understand it. So you end up going to maximum security prison in West Virginia.
Yes.
Which prison did they send you to, and how violent was it? Even among maximum security prisons, there are some that are more chaotic and more violent. So what was your experience?
Well, when I first went into the West Virginia prison system, I went to the West Virginia Penitentiary in Moundsville, West Virginia. And this penitentiary was actually declared unlivable at the time. I guess they were in the process of closing the prison down.
Unlivable, that's an interesting word.
Yeah, because it had been deemed just horrible, the conditions and everything. And I still remember the day I arrived at the prison, and all I could do was just kind of stand back on the wall and look at the different faces of individuals. I mean, I'm from Tampa, Florida. I'm in an environment I know no one. And you have skinheads, Aryan Brotherhoods, motorcycle gangs, Ku Klux Klan. You got a number of gangs within this prison. And it may have been, out of 1,500 prisoners, it may have been 100 black guys. I don't even think it was 100 black guys. It was a different world. It was a very, very different world. The majority of the black guys were, I'm going to say, a little subservient to a degree because they didn't want any trouble. You know, it was certain hits being sent out on individuals. I mean, it was a...
Actual hits.
Oh, yeah. Hmm. Oh, sure. And it was just a completely different world for me at that time. And my first objective was, I got to get to the law library. I got to learn this law. Unfortunately, I was encountered by an individual that ultimately led to me going to lockup for a little bit. So I spent a few years in lockup over an incident I don't choose to speak about today. But it was a fight that turned into a little bit more. And next thing you know, I'm on lockup for a period of years.
And what is that?
Lockup is punitive segregation.
Right.
And on punitive segregation in Moundsville, West Virginia Penitentiary, it's worse than the mainline population. It was pretty rough. You had officers that had shotguns. There's a couple of shotguns on every section, it seems like. Shotgun here, shotgun over here, shotgun, shotgun, shotgun. And you're on the inside, and it's just all this steel, these little cages. I can touch all four walls by just reaching out and touching the walls from north to south, east to west. And the cell was that little, with the little sink, toilet, and the bed. And I stayed over there for a period of time, and that gave me an opportunity to really hone in on who I was and who I am. I started reading. I started studying. I made my way to the law library versus going out to work out. You had an option. You can work out or you can go to the law library. So my law library time started about 2 or 3 in the morning. So I would go to the law library, and it's ironic, one of the Aryan Brotherhood guys, he taught me how to shepherdize, taught me how to go in and read all different cases and familiarize myself with the legal process. He really helped me gain a foundation in law on lockup.
That's focus for a second.
That was my first encounter. And I always tell people, you know, I'm indebted to this guy.
An Aryan Brotherhood guy teaching one of the few black guys in the maximum security prison in West Virginia about the law is something worth spending a moment on. I mean, this is, do you remember this guy's name?
Sure. Joker. Marcus Cochran. We became the best of friends. From not knowing anything to he taking the time out to go over with me in this law library about similar cases, reading up on this, understanding the different writs and filings. And, you know, it was priceless. And I can still hear him saying, you will not do a lot of time on this because this is crazy. Your case will be one of the biggest cases in the state of West Virginia. And all he used to talk about was, man, they're going to pay you so much money. That was what he was saying. And we studied so much, and we really became good friends behind that.
Is he still in?
Yeah, he's still in.
So you were moved around to a few different prisons.
Let me see. From Moundsville, West Virginia Penitentiary, we left there in 1995. They closed the prison down. So I left Moundsville, West Virginia Penitentiary in March of 1995. And I went to Mount Olive Correctional Complex in Mount Olive, West Virginia. I stayed at Mount Olive Correctional Complex for a period of, I don't know, maybe, 17 years. Because I left Mount Olive in 2011. And I went to Huttonsville Correctional Center. I left Huttonsville and went to Northern Correctional Facility. Then I went to Northern Correctional Center. Then I came back to Mount Olive Correctional Complex before I was released. And that was in 2016.
I mean, you really had a tour of the worst places in that anyone can imagine. Let's take the 27 years you were incarcerated. What was the worst thing that you saw or that happened in all that time?
I mean, it's a lot of worse. The worst happened at Moundsville. That was the worst. I go back to the winter of 1993 in Moundsville on lockup. I've never been that cold in my life. All the windows in lockup are knocked out. And this was prior to an incident that happened in 1986. There was a riot there in 1986, and the windows were never replaced.
What?
Yes. So all of these windows are knocked out, and I'm on the fourth tier, I believe, on lockup, and the snow is just blowing in, and it's just cold. I got all the clothes I got. I got all my clothes on. I'm so cold that I don't get up out of bed to eat for a few days. I remember writing in my journal, this is the first time I ate oatmeal. I was so hungry, but, you know, I got up after like day 2 or 3 and ate oatmeal. That was it. But it was so cold that the toilet was literally ice.
What?
In order for me to use the facility, use the restroom, I had to break the ice with my shank. I'd use my knife, my shank, to break the ice in order to use the toilet. I had never been that cold in my life. And I pitched in Wisconsin, Appleton, Wisconsin, right off of Lake Michigan. And I remember being cold off of that Lake Michigan. and I thought that was the coldest. But until I went to Moundsville, West Virginia, that 1993 winter, it was so cold. I kept myself warm by talking and yelling. It was torture. And you gotta try to, I guess, yell and keep moving to stay warm. Yeah, that was pretty rough. That was the roughest time. And then on top of that, I mean, there's stabbings over there every day, if not every other day. So many gangs, there's so many hits being sent out in this little area. And you got stabbings going on. You have the officers using the pump shotguns. I'm still hearing the click, boom. That's the sound.
Shooting guys.
They'll make that warning. They say they make a warning shot, but they'll actually shoot the buckshots into the area. I still remember the guy saying, the next one will get you. I won't miss with the next one. The ring from that shotgun going off. And I'm crawling on the ground, just crawling to try to get away from this situation, because you're not expecting nothing like that to happen. Shooting going on within lockup.
And, no.
I mean, but the stabbings are happening so frequent, and the officers are shooting to stop the stabbings. I mean, not justifying it, but it was just mad lands to me. I'm like, I'm in a crazy, crazy spot. So I had to take my whole psyche to another level. I am in survival mode. I'm going to make it out of here. I still remember that. I'm going to make it out of here. I'm saying to myself, I'm writing this down. I'm going to make it out of here. I'm not going to succumb to this. And, you know, I had that in my writing, in my journal. But I kept myself active, you know, and that's when I would go to the library and I come back, you know, even while I'm studying the law and getting all the information I can, I started reading a lot of different books. I'm reading up on Catholicism, Buddhism, Rastafarianism, Islam, Christianity, the Bhagavad-Gita. I'm reading everything I can read and understanding different faiths. And I'm also at this time doing all my other readings. You know, I always mention Dr. Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. And I always mention James Allen, As a Man Thinketh. I'm just reading so much, and I'm taking time out of my day to read this. Reading was like, this is getting me through the day.
You're freezing, you're starving, and you're trying to avoid being stabbed and shot. Everything else going okay?
Well, yeah. I mean, and I'll say this. I mean, it was very racist in this prison. So you never know when a hit may come your way, when someone may come your way. And you don't have to even be the subject of intent. You don't have to be that person. You don't even know the person. I'll never forget the one guy next to me. He wouldn't come out of the cell. You know, it's guys that wouldn't come out and wouldn't go to shower and wouldn't come out of that cell. And it's okay with the officers. You should stay in the cell. But it's guys that would not come out. And I would go to them. I was like, hey, come on out the cell. Come to the shower. You haven't showered today. You haven't showered in a week. Come on out of there. And, you know, guys would literally say, I'm not coming out there to be killed.
Judge, let me ask you, because I think there's something in the Constitution about cruel and unusual punishment. How does this go on? The scenario that Jimmy is describing, it must be what the Founding Fathers had in mind when they wrote that.
Unfortunately, this is a reality of the country we live in. Now, legally, there would be a great uproar if we found or somebody made a big deal about how some of our elderly are being treated in assisted living homes. But I guarantee you it would be a different situation where the law would react very differently for someone on the outside than they do when we're dealing with prisoners who sometimes we forget are still citizens. They are still Americans. They're still entitled to all of their constitutional rights. And so to answer the question, not passionately, but legally, there is a mechanism to address that. But is it adequate? I would say no.
The scenario that Jimmy's describing, in most states, I think, if you treated your dog that way,
you would go to jail.
You'd go to jail. Yeah, you can't leave your dog in a tiny enclosure in freezing temperatures, sub-freezing temperatures.
It's unconscionable. And I mean, I will say, because of what I do, I have to believe, and I do believe that there is a possibility of justice. So this prison that Jimmy was in was, because of a legal case, condemned. Now, it was condemned 6 years before they closed it, but legally there was a case saying you cannot house people in these conditions. What happens with the administration after that decision comes down is something entirely different. So I would certainly agree. The laws to protect our animals are oftentimes more stringent and more closely followed than we do to protect our brothers and sisters. And that is a very big problem in this country.
It's so nuts, right? One day you're just a person walking around the street with your rights. But as soon as that switch goes off and you're caught up in the criminal justice system, you're not treated as a human being anymore. That's got to change.
And when we look at it, even in the most self-serving way, for the most part, people are going to get out of prison at some point. They're going to be in our neighborhoods. They're going to be in the supermarkets. They're going to be back in society. And if we have treated them as subhuman for however long they're there, we are going to reap the consequences of how they're going to react when they come out. One of the things I admire most about Jimmy is that he'll say that even though he was in jail, his mind was never there.
Well, he's an unusual
person. He is an unusual person. But we really do have to step back and look at how we're treating people, even if you don't care, even if you did something bad and I don't care about you. Be selfish and understand that for the most part, they're going to come back out and then you're going to have to deal with it. That's why we're doing reentry work with people needing jobs, needing housing, all of these things. We have to keep in mind that we are all part of the same society and we've all got to live in it.
We need to do better. We need to do better. We need to treat our people as people. So, Jimmy, how did it transpire? How did you rebound? How did you get out? What was that moment like when you got out?
I was overjoyed. I was released through the federal courts. I spent 46 months in federal court on top of a 23-year inordinate delay in state court. And my mother, Miss Gladys Gardner, you know, my mom's a very, very praying woman, and she has visions. I was waiting up to 6, maybe 5 months at the time, and my mom said, well, I went in the closet, and you coming home. You be getting ready to get your ruling. You coming home this week. She said, so go ahead and pack up everything. And I said, okay, Mom. I was talking to her that Sunday, and I got the call on Friday from my attorney telling me that the case had been overturned, conviction vacated, and either set for retrial or release. And I called and let my mother know that Friday. I said, Mama, I got the ruling. But she already saw it.
She saw a vision.
Yeah.
Didn't.
Like I said, my mother's very, very praying. Very, very praying and spiritual. And I had been preparing for April 1st, seemed like all my life. Every year that would go by, I'd pray, I said, God, please let me come home this year. It's January 1st. And I'd watch that ball drop right here in New York. I'd watch that ball drop and I'd say, God, let this be my year. One day I'm going to go and watch that ball drop. And I said that, and I believe that 100%, wholeheartedly. Every year I would say, God, let this be the year. That's a lot, few decades went by. But I watched that ball drop, and I watched that every year. Let this be my year. And I go through my years in prison letting guys know I'm going home this year.
Well, let's go back to that, though, because you actually bumped into a very principled judge who made a very strong ruling and an even stronger statement mm-hmm. when he announced that your conviction was being overturned. And you must have very special feelings for that man. I don't know him, but I'd like to meet him sometime, shake his hand. So can you talk about that?
Oh, yes, I can. With great pleasure. You're speaking about District Court Judge Joseph R. Goodwin out of the Southern District of West Virginia. I filed my case into his court in June of 2012. And November of 2013, Judge Joseph R. Goodwin granted my petition and enabled me to come into federal court, which was a miracle because I had no standing, no legal standing. And I also filed under denial of access to the court, denial of equal protection and due process, which aren't, you know, issues that aren't cognizable in federal court. You know, it has to be an issue dealing with constitutional violation that emanated from your trial. So I'm going in already knowing this. And I tell you, I placed one of my petitions into my filing because I was asked to do that by a guy by the name of Cornell Day. So he said, man, you got so many petitions you filed in court, man. Just go ahead and throw one in. Let them know you have something. So I did that. But Judge Goodwin denied my petition, but he granted me into federal court because of my exhibit of one of my state court petitions. And at the end of the day, Judge Goodwin ruled that I had shown that I had issues that may warrant some relief in federal court. So he's going to give me that opportunity to present my petition to the court and get my case heard for the first time. get my case reviewed for the first time. This is a first-time review. I went in federal court under a de novo review. My first time getting a review in 24 years, which was remarkable. But Judge Goodwin stated in his opinion that I had been in legal purgatory and that it had been a total miscarriage of justice, which were some very strong words, very strong words. And I just know that in order for Judge Goodwin to have the courage to do that in the state of West Virginia, that took so much courage. That took so much. I mean, I can't even express it to the audience. And within Judge Goodwin's opinion, I mean, he's right across the hall in the same city as the state judge that sentenced me to 110 years. And they're good friends.
Wow. And let me just read something, because Judge Holliday said that Zane's, and I'm quoting, pattern and practice of misconduct completely undermined the validity and reliability of any forensic work he performed or reported, and that as a matter of law, any testimonial or documentary evidence offered by Zane at any time in any criminal prosecution should be deemed invalid, unreliable, and inadmissible in determining whether to award a new trial in any subsequent habeas corpus proceeding. Bam! Mm-hmm. Right? So I can ask the judge. It sounds to me like the judge was pissed.
That was from the Supreme Court of West Virginia. And yes, he was very upset. And that should have formed the basis for an immediate rehearing, if not release. That decision, I believe, came out in 93.
Mm-hmm. November of 1993.
So that ruling came out saying that every person who had been prosecuted by or convicted because of testimony from Zane should get a rehearing. Jimmy, I think, was granted four.
More than that. One of the real injustices here isn't just Zane's deplorable and illegal behavior, is that once that Supreme Court did its investigation and ordered a new trial for not just Jimmy, but anyone who had been convicted based on Zane's evidence, they either were going to be released or they would have to be retried. And the local prosecutors in these jurisdictions had to determine which one it was going to be. The local prosecutors in Jimmy's case decided that they were going to retry him, rightfully or wrongfully. But then the trial judge in this case, when he would file his petitions, and you say he filed four, I think he filed more than that, but yeah, there were several state habeas corpus petitions filed pursuant to the Supreme Court decision, the state Supreme Court decision, and this particular judge refused to give him a hearing. So he languished for 10 to 15 years. 20 years in a state of legal purgatory, mm-hmm, essentially, because he could not go to the federal system until his state case or state habeas case had been tried or heard. And for 20 years, they didn't hear it or try it. And so he languished. He finally filed something in federal court out of desperation. And this judge, this federal judge, took it up despite the standing issues, because how abhorrent the state system had treated him. He had never had a hearing. So when you talk about those who contributed mightily to his 27-year incarceration, it just wasn't the state police and Zane. It was also the judiciary at the state level that worked purposely to ensure that he would be in legal purgatory for 20 years. So 20 of the 27 years, even after Zane was found out, it was the system and the state court system that kept him there. And so when you talk about making him whole, it's not about Zane, just about Zane and the state police department. It's the state judiciary system and the prosecutors who knew he was in prison, knew he was suffering, knew they were under court order to give him a hearing, and knew that they weren't giving him that. It really is abhorrent. And so the fact of the matter is, but for this federal district court judge who found a way legally to rule, right, and to direct them to give him a new hearing or to let him go, because now we're with a federal court judge who's got a lifetime appointment and says, let him go by some date certain or retry him. Even after all of that, the same state prosecutors, the same state police offered or decided to retry him again. and on the eve of trial, on the day of trial, approached the bench and decided they weren't going to retry him, allegedly because of lost witnesses or lost memory of witnesses. That wasn't the case. They couldn't prove the case 27 years ago. They couldn't prove it 27 years later. The bottom line proposition, because anything that Zane had touched and anything that the state lab and those working with Zane had touched was not credible. And the whether you had the witnesses or not, it was the tainted evidence that ultimately convicted him. And that's the second tragedy of his incarceration.
It is absolutely fucking nuts that Zane was exposed and actually indicted in 1993.
But he had gone to Texas, right? Had gotten fired from the position in Texas. And when he came back, the state police and had welcomed him back. Despite all the findings against him, he worked as a consultant to them and convicted other people on bad evidence when he returned.
Right, powerful bad evidence, too. I mean, because, again, hard to argue with a guy that's up there talking science that people may or may not even
and
understand.
And poor people can't challenge it. I often wondered, with Jimmy and even the prosecution on the other side, now that I'm involved in the case, post his release, is who could find the motivation to wrongfully convict hundreds of innocent people based on bad analysis, poor analysis, or just perjured testimony on a repetitive basis, a practice, a part and practice of wrongfully convicting people? What motivates a human being in law enforcement who most of them swear to the Constitution and to the flag and wear the flag on their sleeves, on their shoulders, right? To wrongfully convict and criminally, through criminal conduct, convict innocent people? Where does that come from? What manner of man is that?
Yeah, and of course, we know that in every one of these cases in which Zane and others like him have deliberately, willfully, wrongfully testified against people like Jimmy, who they knew were innocent, in every one of those cases, the actual perpetrator remained free to go and go and commit other
exactly.
heinous acts.
A whole nother bucket.
It's a whole nother bucket.
You're absolutely right about that.
It's an inescapable truth. But, you know, I want to talk about the good stuff. When you actually were let free, did you walk out of the courtroom like in the movies into the sunlight? Is that what happened?
It was on April 1st after the hearing. And this hearing is to decide whether or not I'm going to be retried or released. And Judge Joanna Tabbitt, I'm in her courtroom. And like my attorney, Scott Bolden, said, the state decided they were going to retry. So Judge Joanna Tabbitt set a bond in my case. And she asked my mother, Miss Gardner, can you please stand? And my mother stood up. And my mother told her, yes, ma'am. She said, can you tell me what kind of bond can you make? And my mom said, I think I can make $10,000. And Judge Tabbitt, you know, which is one of the greatest judges in West Virginia right now, her and Judge Joseph R. Goodman, federal judge, she said, well, the bond is set at $10,000. She said, Mr. Gardner, take him home with you. Take him home. And my mother, my sisters, Barbara Gardner, Harrison, Tracy Sims, my brother, Eric Gardner, my other brothers, my friend, Sheila Lewis, so many other people, my nephews and, you know, my nieces. It's so many people waiting on me to walk out of that jail. I walked out of that jail on April 1st to the arms of my family. And that moment was so exhilarating. You know, all of us, we just met with a big group hug. And I embraced everyone, and we shared a lot of tears of joy. Of course, the news reporter was like, well, you know, they're seeking to retry, Mr. Gardner. In my mind, I already knew this was over. This was over. And my mother said, they can do whatever they want to try, this and that. She said, this is over. She said, my God told me this is over. Mm. And I knew it was over. So I embraced my family. We hugged. Man, we went out to eat. We went to the hotel and partied. And I mean, we partied. Man, you can't define it. Words can't explain it.
No, I couldn't even imagine. So meanwhile, a crazy thing happened just a couple of months ago, because you've been out now for about 22 months. What was the date of the formal exoneration?
September 7th, 2016.
So there was another milestone, right?
Yes.
You knew it was coming, but it still had to be a great feeling.
And yes, sir.
You were telling me earlier about a crazy story in the best possible way. Do you want to talk about that?
Okay. I'll just say this. You know, since I've came home, I've had the opportunity to speak. I do my own speaking now. I'm J.C. Gardner Speaks. I have a Gardner House incorporated in Beckley, West Virginia. That house is a house for returning citizens, giving men opportunities to have housing, clothing, food. This is going to get off the ground pretty soon. I'm in the process of renovating it now. And I've been speaking and been fortunate to meet so many people and attend so many different universities, Congressional Black Caucuses. I mean, it's just been phenomenal, phenomenal, to say the least, the opportunities that I've had. But last year, I happened to meet Judge Leslie Abrams in Albany, Georgia. We were at a Georgia Black Women Lawyers Associating a party or something like that. And I just happened to meet Leslie, and we talked, I don't know, maybe hour or so. It was extended time. And it was at that time that I realized it was something that that was really gravitating me toward her. And, you know, I felt like I had found what I was looking for. And today, Leslie and I are a couple. I mean, my blessings have been, it's like a river flowing.
You found love in the form of the judge who happens to be sitting right next to me right now. What a, like, an amazing circle now, right?
Yes.
I mean, talk about the criminal justice system giving back, right? I mean, you know, it's like for somebody who has been as wronged as you can be, it's an amazing and wonderful,
yes,
beautiful part of the story. And you're a lucky man.
I'm
so
very fortunate.
The luckiest of the unluckiest people that I know. So, there you go.
I'll say this, Jason. I've been blessed beyond imagination. I can't even describe it. I've met nothing but great people since I've been home. It's almost like everything you encounter is gold. Everything that I have encountered since my time of being home has been good for me. I'm in a situation where I know I've been blessed beyond imagination and beyond the normal human being can be blessed their entire lives. I'm fortunate to have a great attorney such as Scott Bolden sitting next to me. I'm fortunate to have a great lady in my life, the Honorable Judge Leslie Abrams. I'm blessed my mother and father are still here. My sisters and brothers are still on this earth with me. I'm in the presence of my nieces and nephews and my family members all the time. I am blessed beyond comparison. And I'm blessed with health. To come out of Moundsville, West Virginia Penitentiary and go into Mount Olive Correctional Complex, to come out of this situation after 27 years and be healthy mentally, physically, and spiritually is beyond a blessing.
It's a miracle.
Now, I am in the process of taking some, getting some psychiatric help as far as, because you can't go in water and not expect to get wet. So I do have to take some classes, get myself reacclimated back, get some psychiatric help in that regard, just going through the process, sharing my bad times perceived with individuals, with a psychiatrist, being in a position to say, hey, I'm not at any level trying to say I'm totally unblemished or unharmed by this process, because you can't jump in water and not get wet. So I recognize that I'm blessed beyond the majority, but in the position that I am today, my position is to be able to tell my story to people and let them know, hey, it is not how you start, it's how you finish. And it's not what you go through in life, it's how you deal with what you go through in life. Because we all go through something. Everybody got a story. And I tell people that. Your story is just as important as my story. But it's how you deal with it and how you understand that you can only get through it by really tapping into your higher power and understanding that it's beyond you. And I tell people every day, they say, why did this happen to you? I say, it's not even about me. It's not even about me. It's beyond me. It's a level of me being placed on this earth, not to play baseball, basketball, football, none of that, but to be an activist, an individual that's against injustice, to share my story with people, hoping that I can give them the inspiration and motivation to know that whatever you're going through in life, you can come out of it and you can be in the best position of your life if you truly believe in your higher power. And I stress that to tell people, look, if you can go through it, whatever you're going through, God will not place a burden upon you greater than you can handle. So know going in, if you're going through it, you can handle it. It's purposeful.
You know, usually on the show, I open up the mic to the featured guest for closing thoughts. I feel like you actually just took the words right out of my mouth. Yeah. And that was amazing. So, Jimmy, how do people, if they want to book you, if they want to donate to your new center that you're building?
Gardner House Incorporated. www.jcgardnerspeaks.com. I'm on Twitter at jcgardnerspeaks. And I'm also Instagram, jcgardnerspeaks.
You got that handle. I'm gonna follow you, and I hope other people will too. And Scott, how do people reach you if they are in need of your services?
A. Bolden, B-O-L-D-E-N, at Reed, R-E-E-D, Smith.com, with the law firm of Reed Smith. I would argue that these are very difficult cases. They take a long time. And then there's the second story of recovery, of how do you make someone like Jimmy Gardner whole? Not just emotionally or physically or practically or legally, but financially. He's lost 27 years of his life. What is his life worth after 27 years of being in prison? Be welcome to look at other cases. I can tell you, I'm super focused on Jimmy's case, though, because we have a couple of lawsuits pending in West Virginia. So despite all of this and all the reports, the state of West Virginia continues to fight. Now, they're free to fight, obviously. These are civil lawsuits. But given the overwhelming evidence and even the judicial reports that confirm this type of really abhorrent behavior, not just by the state lab, but also by individuals in the criminal justice system there, our hope and our goal is that we will resolve those cases so he can move on completely away from those 27 years. Right now, we're still fighting, though.
And then lastly, I do also like to have our other featured guests share any last thoughts, anything that you want to get off your chest or anything you want to tell the audience. Judge.
Well, I would say that one of my passions when I was a federal prosecutor, I was an AUSA in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Atlanta. I was hired by Sally Yates. And Sally Yates always talked about doing justice, but she talked about it as a three-legged stool. And one of those legs, it was enforcement, prosecution, but it was also prevention and reentry. She was very adamant about that. And I hope that if anything comes out of this, one of the things that when I met Jimmy, he said we talked for a very long time. And part of that was talking about, one, how someone could go through that experience and come out with the spirit that he's come out with, but also what he was doing. We talked about Gardner House, about how he was trying to help other people reenter into society. I was the community outreach coordinator for the U.S. Attorney's Office a period during my time there, and I did reentry work. I continue to do reentry work as a judge because I think it's very, very important for us to give returning citizens an opportunity. Not everybody has a family that's going to be standing outside when they come home. Not everybody is going to have a home to go to, food to eat, even understand the resources. Jimmy is extremely educated, but the majority of people that I see in my court have not graduated from high school, would not be able to navigate the system as he did, because it hasn't been said, but understand, the petition that got him out, he wrote. He had 13 lawyers over the years. The only one to file that federal writ was him, and he did it himself. Not everybody has that opportunity. And so if anything, what I would say and is the most important thing that I think can come out is that people understand that these were our brothers and sisters when they went into prison, whether rightfully or wrongfully convicted. And they are our brothers and sisters when they come out. One of the reasons, and Jimmy and I talk about fate, I'm the daughter of two United Methodist ministers. My father ran Coast Prison Ministries when I was a child, so I spent a good deal of time in jail. Mm. I spent several birthdays in jail. Mm-hmm. And one thing I was always taught is not your circumstances. It's how you deal with those circumstances. And one of the things that really has drawn me to Jimmy is I have been inordinately blessed in my life. I can't imagine confronting what he's confronted and doing it with the grace that he has done it with.
Amen to that.
And so I just say, if anyone is listening, please reach out, look at what opportunities for reentry are there in your communities and try to get involved, because we are all part of the society and we've got to figure out how to make us all one.
As Leslie said, I went through 13 attorneys throughout about a 23-year period. I went through 13 attorneys that never filed a habeas corpus or on my behalf. And I strongly suggest to people to have legal representation before you encounter any type of situation that is similar to mine or just like mine. We have life insurance, we got home insurance, car insurance, and these insurances are something that we're paying for prior to us getting involved in an accident, or prior to us dying, or prior to us having something happen to our home or something. So I am a Legal Shield associate. You can pay a fee that will cover you. And if you're getting involved in any type of accidents, be covered. Have an attorney already on standby and have access to your attorney 24/7. Questions 24/7. I'm covered. I want you to be covered. And it's LegalShieldAssociate.com/JimmyCGardner. And you can actually reach me and go on and sign up right now and be covered.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.